recall exactly, but somewhere around 1967 or so, what had been Mura dissolved, and a lot of the faculty here, senior, you know, scientists, senior staff or whatever, went to Fermilab. There was a lot of activity that had gone on at Mira, and its history is separately being written up and compiled by a few Murons, and I assume you're on top of that, but that history is being written by Don Young. Let's see, Frank Cole's now deceased. He would have been doing that. Keith Simon, Fred Mills, but just some stunning work that was done back in those days. And there have been a number of models. There were Michigan models, Illinois models, Wisconsin models of the FFAG. And those were, I don't know if it was actually an FFG that was being proposed or not, but those led up to what was a national competition about that time for a national facility, which became Fermilab. And I think there were three final finalists in that competition. I think Michigan was one of them, but I'm not sure of that. The other was Illinois, who got Fermilab, and the other was Wisconsin. And had that accelerator been built, and my understanding is it would have been across the Schneider, north of Schneider Drive here. Actually, I've got some rock samples in my office, but all you have to do is drive, go down to Highway 51 and drive south down towards Stoughton and look at the rock cut down by the trailer park there. And you can see the rock that basically is a foundation that's all under this area, which is great for building accelerators. And anyway, Wisconsin lost out in that competition. And that accelerator, proton machine, was built finally. It was actually built at Weston, Illinois, which no longer exists because they literally obliterated it from the map. And so it's going to be called Batavia. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's down in Illinois. And it was said that two principal reasons for it having gone there were Senator Everett Dirksen, who was a senior Republican senator of no little political clout, and also the nearby presence of O'Hare Airport. Anyway, so a lot of the staff went down to Fermilab. So you had Stan Snowden, he's now deceased, Don Young, Frank Cole, Dick, I can't remember his last name right offhand. There were a whole bunch of people that went down there from different disciplines. And it left a considerable vacuum here. Two or three people that were left behind, if you will, or stayed behind, it's not like they were left behind, they stayed behind, were Keith Simon, and Keith's a story in his own right, but he became professor of physics. Keith has since been awarded a major, a couple of years ago, a major prize through the Particle Accelerator Conference. We can go and look up more of that detail, but written what at the time was classic book on undergraduate mechanics, and it was a world-accepted text on the subject. And he taught an accelerator course or two while he was down there, and he was extremely good at what's called Hamiltonian mechanics. And then you also had Don Kerst, who was the inventor of the Betatron, who was here as part of that Mira staff. He went on to be a professor of physics down on campus. And then you had Fred Mills, and he also became a professor of physics. And then you had some of these guys, Don Young, whom I've mentioned, Stan Snowden, who, in a sense, kept a foot at the university because they had adjunct professorships. So although they were at Fermilab, it wasn't quite clear how that transition worked. But Stan Snowden, for example, taught a full semester accelerator course here, but did end up down at Fermilab. Well, two students that took that course were Walt Treziak, whom I'm sure you know, and myself. And, I don't know what year that would have been, but it probably would have been around 67, 68, somewhere in there. Anyway, come around that time, all these guys had disappeared pretty much down to Fermilab, and was looking around campus to find out, what was to be done in the field, and came across Fred Mills down in physics, and he said, "Oh, well, why don't you come out to Tantalus, and we'll find something for you to do while I was a graduate student." And in those days, there was not any distinction between PSL and SRC, Tantalus. It was just all, it was what was left over, the legacy of MIRA, which, and then the separate parts of the staff were taking on different roles. So PSL evolved as its own entity within the graduate school, doing contract work, if you will. SRC evolved as its own entity, all coming from a common staff, if you will, but we all shared the facility, which was the PSL building over here. And in those days, we operated Tantalus, and I'm sure you're also familiar with, won't go into too much detail there. But they had the Wisconsin model for the FFAG as an injector, and I can't begin to tell you, it's mind-boggling how complicated that machine was. But for example, and it sort of defies intuition, that machine could accelerate and contain electrons in both directions. So you could have electrons going opposite each other in the same machine. In particular, you could do collider physics in that machine. Well, anyway, so it was very complicated. You've got to remember, this is back before the days of what we consider modern-day computing, way before those days. Here we had a vacuum tube, I think it was an IBM 704, that took up the entire electronic shop over at PSL in those days. But these guys were just incredibly gifted as far as being able to work out problems either intuitively or back of the envelope, or just incredibly good at understanding how things worked without doing a lot of modeling as we do today. And so the FFAG was an incredibly complicated machine that in its later days, after FFAG research sort of died here at Wisconsin, became used solely for the purpose of injecting into Tantalus. And so my project became to design a new injector for Tantalus, which was a conventional microtron. So that was the nature of my graduate research.
Could you just describe the difference between the microtrons and the FFAG? Some of the big points?
I need a chalkboard for that, but didn't need a chalkboard or a piece of paper. I could do it with a piece of paper.
Sure, if you'd like.
All kinds of references on these things. I do have glasses. Do you just have a regular 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper?
Something like that.
Okay, because I'm afraid my drawings strongly resemble scribbles. Okay. FFAG has sort of wedge-like sectors, if you will, so the, I guess the safest thing to do is just to go around sort of drawing wedges all over the place, but let's see, wait, I'm going to put this into your scrapbook there, your notebook there, because I make a hell of a mess. So anyway, these things were all it was a pattern like this, and these things were magnets, and they would alternate. I probably didn't end up with the right number, but let's see if I ended up with the right. No, I didn't. I needed another wedge in here. But anyway, the idea would be that they would alternate in sign, so that you'd have one that would have a, say, a plus field and a minus, mm-hmm. and then plus, and minus, and plus, minus, plus, and obviously I'm missing a little guy over in here. But anyway, and then you'd end up with a scalloped orbit that would, it's kind of hard to draw this.
Yeah.
Anyway, it would go in kind of a wobbly orbit, and let's see. I don't know enough about the physics of these things. Somehow, I think the idea was to. Actually, I think I might have misspoken before. I'm not sure if you could counter, so I have to go back and check that. I don't know that you can counter. I think, yeah, you can. But I think what gets interesting, in other words, this thing has got symmetry. It doesn't make any difference which way you're going around it. But if you had electrons going in this thing in either direction, I guess what's interesting about it is you've got something that's sort of topologically circular. And with magnets of alternating sign, it just sort of defies intuition to suggest you get a closed orbit out of this thing, but you do. I mean, in Aladdin or Tantalus, for example, all your dipoles are bending the same direction. These are bending in opposite, they alternate and then in opposite directions, and yet you can still go around, but it's as I say, sort of a funny lobed pattern. And so if I had electrons going the opposite way, they'd be on the same path, which isn't very, I don't think that was their intent. So what they, so recall what they were going to do was to use, I've got all kinds of technical descriptions. Actually, they wrote a very lengthy, it was a compilation of papers, but a very lengthy note on how the FFAG worked, and this, of which this is an incredibly poor substitute. But anyway, if you had positrons, I think the idea was to have positrons going possibly in this thing, mm-hmm. and then the positrons would have and the positrons would be doing
yeah.
a pattern like this. Anyway, the idea is that you'd end up with these collision points in between here where you could have E plus E minus collisions. Anyway, so this thing was a way over the top complicated injector for, and I can't remember how they ever got beam out of this thing. Normally they used what there was a technique called resonant extraction. My guess is this was using resonant extraction. And I really haven't begun to show how complicated this thing was. There, the means of, part of the acceleration was you had a couple of cores in here, betatron cores, and there was one on each side of the ring, as I recall. One was kind of a pastel red, the other was a pastel green. And they were used for betatron induction acceleration early on. And somewhere in here was, you know, a very low energy injector assembly and so forth. Somehow they got, and I'll just draw this schematically, they had beam coming out of this thing, if you will, and that went off to Tantalus. And as I said, it was only used for E minus. Mm-hmm. But the idea was to, and then Tantalus, this little guy that was over here, this tiny little guy, it was, I'm not going to get the circumference right, but it had a circumference of maybe only, I'm going to say 10 or 15 feet. It was very, very small. That's a guess, 15 maybe.
Oh, the Tantalus storage ring?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. That's not about right.
Right. And so the idea was that this could have been an E plus, E minus storage ring, so that you would now, in something that was more circular, have had, say, electrons going one way, and you could have had positrons going the opposite way. And then you could have had these guys colliding head-on in the ring. And but it, there, to my knowledge, positrons were never injected into or stored in either the FFAG, let alone in Tantalus. Because in order to do this, I'm sure it wasn't done in Tantalus, in order to do this in Tantalus, what you have to separately do is bring the positrons. There would have had to be a separate injection path over here to do the positrons. Okay? And anyway. Well, let's see. I think we do know the circumference. Circumference, this would have been about, let's see, 15. It would have been about 6 meters. I think it would have been about 18 feet then. I think the circumference is around 6 meters. I can go into why I say that, but that's neither here nor there. So anyway, this was the FFAG. Needed to, very expensive to operate, maintain, and use for lowly purpose of injection. So it basically got replaced by a microtron that was, I'll crudely draw it over here someplace, and this thing has back legs that are, it's a sandwich basically. It's got a top pole, a bottom pole, and then it's got side supports between the poles, and then inside of which there was a vacuum chamber that looks like this. And over here there would have been, I'm pretty sure it was over here, this, you had a cavity, then there's a waveguide that comes in here, there's a cavity, this drawing is not too small for me to put how the injection worked, but the idea was you'd have electrons that would go around this thing. Like, this was not a racetrack. I can separately go into what it looks like. This is all a uniform field in here. So this whole region is uniform, highly uniform, as you know, to within parts of 10 to the fourth. Mm-hmm. So this is a highly uniform B field. And so that makes this a conventional microtron, if you will. So conventional.
So how does that differ from Aladdin's?
We'll come back to that in a second. Okay, and so anyway, the way a microtron works is every time the beam passes through that cavity, it picks up more energy, and because this is a fixed field, with more energy it goes to a greater circumference orbit. And it goes through again, goes to a larger orbit, goes through again, goes to a larger orbit. Well, it finally gets out here, and you literally stick in it's a specially magnetic shielded tube. I started out drawing this as being the vacuum vessel, but I'll use this as the last orbit now. And so what you do is you stick in a shielded tube, electrons go down that tube, and then they go out to, and they use bending magnets and so forth. And so that was, when I was a graduate student, that was my principal project, doing that new injector. Okay, so that would be a conventional microtron. A racetrack microtron is, rather than having a uniform field, a giant uniform field, which gets harder to make as this thing gets to higher energy. Mm-hmm. So this thing actually had a peak energy of, oh, there's an error bar on this, but I'm going to put down, I think it was around 34, I think it was around 34 MeV. See, is that true? Am I lying? No, I think that's true. Squiggle. I think it was an apple.
Sure.
I'd have to go and look that up, actually. So, put a question mark after it's subject to verification. Anyway, so then in a racetrack microtron, what you do is you take that and you pull it apart. So instead, you have a magnet over here, a magnet over here, both of which have, well, for the purpose of this discussion, it's not a uniform field, but each one of them has a uniform field that's all, it doesn't have to be this way, but it's just, I also designed this injector too, so. You could have done this a half dozen different ways, but the idea is that this is mostly, this is a constant B field plus taper. And so the field was stronger here than it was out here. So if you were to have drawn a profile of what the B field looked like in this thing, it would have fallen. This is grossly exaggerated, but it is, as I went that way from this edge, the field would have fallen off gradually.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then over here it would have done the same thing, but in reverse. It would have done something like that. Okay. So anyway, you have these. What you've done is take the conventional microtron, you pull it apart. Now you have a drift space in here, and then with that drift space, you're free to, rather than have just a lowly single cell cavity, you can put in a really snazzy LINAC. And so, turns out, I built that LINAC too, but which is neither here nor there. But it's the sort of thing that somebody just out of graduate school can do. And so this has RF input, and then it's actually five full cells and two half cells. So I'll get this wrong, I'm sure, but it's sort of one, two, three, four, five, and then there's a little half cell here on the end that was meant to be a half cell. Okay, and then what you do is this is RF power coming in. And now you have another, everything, there's a cascading of injectors. So somewhere out here you have a cathode, and then you have all sorts of solenoids for focusing and all sorts of things. And this was 30, sort of around 35 kilovolt mm-hmm. electrons off of a cathode. And that was your source of electrons, and then they'd come in here. They would get bent in. I'm not going to draw the bending magnets. They'd go through the LINAC. They'd pick up 5 MeV. They go down. Actually, on the leading edge of these magnets, there is a reverse field region. And so now I'm going to confuse things by showing that this would go up, and then it would go down negative. And then, I didn't put zero on put zero way down here. So let's say that zero. And then the field would go to zero after that. And so, something like mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, and so there's this little thin, this is not accurate, it's only conceptual. So there's a reverse field region here at the beginning, and the electron beam would actually come into this thing. It would make a 180 degree turn, a little teardrop,
yeah. And
then it goes right back on itself. So first it's going that way, and then it's going that way. Okay, so it goes down in here, kind of bends off to the side, and kind of does something like that. And then it goes skittering just past the outside edge of the LINAC, and it goes through. Anyway, then it, again, it's just like the conventional microtron, then it's, actually got two sheets of paper. So it's like a conventional microtron after that again. So it went through here once, 5 MeV, came mm-hmm. back and went through there again in the opposite direction. Now it's up to 10 MeV, so that's 10 MeV. This is also 10, well, I'm going to...
Can you write that on there?
I'm gonna write it over here, actually, because what's going to happen now is it's going to go through again. So now it's 10.15. Came through here again, and then you'd have another orbit that would have been out in here like that. And that's now, this is 15. And another one that's 20. It's gaining 5 MeV every time, so... Delta E is equal to 5 MeV. And then you finally get way out here, and I think we've gotten this thing up to 108 MeV or something of the sort, and your electrons are coming around the outside, and you can actually put in a low field region out here just by cutting away some of the iron. And that last orbit, I should draw just some of these orbits. I'll just draw the last orbit. Last orbit's coming around. Normally it would have been 180 degrees, but it hits a low field region here, and it comes out at an angle, and it just auto-extracts. There's no active electronics or anything. So it auto-extracts, and there you are. And so now you're at something like 108 MeV. And this is all in a vacuum chamber here in the middle. It's pretty simple. There's some steering that's in here.
Could you explain again, the forces of these magnetic or of these magnets here?
Forces or the
just the fields of what you're describing.
Yeah. Suppose we have a magnet that looks like that, and I'm going to look at it this way. So this is the reverse field region. So say, let's see, I might as well get the directions right here. So it's So actually, the B field, I've got the sign reversed. The B field, I've got it reversed. Field's actually, it's large but negative here, so I'll put a minus sign in that. And then it's actually positive here. So we're going to look at this assembly from the side, and then the whole thing will get flipped over here. And then what you have is, I have to take out a lot of detail here, but there are a pair of poles. They're actually in what's called a Purcell filter geometry. That's another description. Okay, obviously I wasn't very accurate there. But these guys have a bit of a taper to them. They're not exactly parallel, so this face is really very slightly tapered, like, oh, let's see, which way does that go? Taper goes the other way. Sorry, gets slightly larger. That's why the field goes down, so forget that. So the taper goes slightly the other way. And so the field here is like that, and the field there is like that. Mm-hmm. And there's actually, there's an inner set of poles that's actually part of the vacuum chamber, outside of which you then have a larger magnet structure that's the return field and coil geometry. And at this point, we should really go downstairs, and it's much easier if it's in front of us to talk about all this. So anyway, those are conventional racetrack microtrons, FFAG, and we were talking about after Mira left that we then had Mills, Simon, and Hurst. They were down in physics, and Mills said, "Hey, why don't you come out here?" And so about 1969 or so. Somewhere in there, I'd passed. I was actually in applied math and engineering physics at Wisconsin as an undergraduate. It was a fabulous major. and the engineering component of which was nuclear engineering. And it turned out that although Fred Mills was in physics, Stan Snowden, when he taught his accelerator course, actually did it in nuclear engineering. And so a good place for doing something like this, which was in a engineering research environment, if you will, was to do it over in nuclear engineering, which in those days had three parts to it. There was the old fission reactor kind of activity, but then handwriting was kind of on the wall that was going to slow down for a very long period of time. Fusion reactors were just ramping up. That pretty much took over a lot of the activity in the department. And there was a very, very tiny little splinter group of activity in accelerator physics, which basically just captured Walt and I, and I think that was that Walt Treziak and I, and basically that was it. And so about 1969, I'd passed qualifiers in nuclear engineering, and Fred Mills had, I think, spring of that year or whatever, said, well, why don't you come out to PSL? So that's what I ended up doing immediately, as a graduate student, but this is what I did immediately after the racetrack microtron, immediately after I got out of graduate school. And then this, of course, was in the context of our having gotten funded for Aladdin, and that's a whole other story in its own right, and I'm sure you're separately putting together a lot of that. Mm-hmm. I do instantly have a lot of the, there was a series of internal working group meetings, discussions, and minutes were taken of that working group. And I've got a number of those meeting minutes, if anybody is interested.
Yeah.
For after Aladdin was, Ed Rowe got like five or six of us together in a small conference room, engineering, what's called the engineering conference room at PSL. And so it would have been Ed and Bill Winter, Charlie Pruitt, Roger Oddy, Walt, myself. We were in sort of a three-way competition, if you will, although everybody got a piece of the action. We had applied for funding for Aladdin. Brookhaven was, this probably would have been for NSLS, the X-ray ring at NSLS, they were after funding for that, and Stanford was after some extended funding for the, extra funding for its Spear facility, I think. And so we all got some amounts of money, but we got a new facility out of it, which was Aladdin. And Ed got us all together, and he said, well, the good news is we got funded. The bad news is now we got to build the damn thing. And I couldn't possibly describe that to you, but he was a never-ending fountain of limericks, colorful jokes, a very, very talented guy when it came to RF electronics. He was part of a completely vanished breed of person that in many ways was just self-taught, and you just put him in a laboratory environment and he could just go wild just cooking up stuff. So anyway, he got us all together, and was how talent or how Aladdin got funded and started. And so I have the meetings for those minutes. The other person that was very influential in all that was Cliff Olson, right from day one. And I'm sure you separately know mm-hmm. about Cliff. And so he represented the user side of the equation, made just numerous very practical input comments to the exercise in terms of how to orient the ring, beam lines, lengths of straight sections. There were these interactive discussions that went on. And there were actually a number of different designs for what Aladdin might have looked like, and Of course, we ended up with a more or less squared off design that we've got now.
Yeah. Great. That's great for now.
Okay.